So yes, I've been thinking about the urban retreat. Well, I'm on the urban retreat, so I've been thinking about it. But what is interesting about the urban retreat, to me, is how it seems to have, over the years, just generated its own momentum. Like, I'm part of the little team of us leading the retreat, and somebody was saying to me yesterday or so, they said, "Oh, well, well done for leading the urban retreat." And I thought, well, actually, I don't know if well done is really appropriate because I almost literally don't feel like I'm doing anything. Like, I feel like the retreat now just sort of does itself. Like, every year, more and more people seem to want to take part in the urban retreat, and it seems to almost do itself with maybe just a little bit of steering from us. And so what I was thinking about is just wondering, well, why is that? What is it that's how come it's got its own momentum so much? And I was thinking, I think, you can tell me if this is right, but I think what's captured our collective imagination about the urban retreat is that we know, we intuitively know that living a life, trying to live a life that's more and more based on values such as awareness, values such as kindness, in other words, a Dharma life, isn't a sort of part-time thing, isn't something we can do as a hobby, isn't something that we can just sort of do a night, a week, or even just do when we go off on retreat. If it's kind of to be worth anything, it has to be something that's more and more a flavour of our whole lives. Well, certainly that's for me, that's why I get excited about the urban retreat, because it's trying to bring that notion more alive. The even in my London life, which even for me, although I work full time at the Buddhist Centre, can feel like quite a busy life, full of well, many distractions. But if I'm trying to live a Dharma life, it has to be something that I'm doing all the time. It can't just be for special occasions. And if that is what we're trying to do, then the sort of principal thing we need to do is work on transforming our minds. That's what all these conditions are for. That's kind of why we have a Buddhist centre, why we have retreats, is to help individuals, including ourselves, transform our minds. I want to qualify what I mean by mind before I go on. By mind, in Buddhism, mind includes something much more than just our brains, our heads. Mind includes, well, the whole being, the heart as well, even more than the heart, really. I was going to say mindset, but that doesn't sound strong enough. It's like the whole orientation of our being. It's like we're trying to turn round, transform the whole orientation of our being. And yeah, that takes pretty persistent effort. It takes a sort of day-to-day, even moment-by-moment application of effort. And that's what we're going to be exploring over the next 5 nights. I do encourage you to come to as many of these evenings as you can, because they all are going to hang together. And what we're going to be exploring, starting tonight, is the five vital qualities of the mind. These are also known as the five spiritual faculties, but I quite like the way we've sort of glossed them for this retreat, the five vital qualities of the mind, remembering what I've just explained, that the mind includes our whole being. So these five are, their faith, or the Buddhist word is Shraddha. Energy, the Buddhist word is Virya. Mindfulness, the Buddhist word is Smriti. Absorption, the Buddhist word is Samadhi. And wisdom, and the Buddhist word is Pranya. So we're going to be exploring these five, starting with Shraddha, or faith, tonight. And we can look at this set of five in two ways. We can look at them as qualities that we're developing simultaneously, a bit the way that all the petals of a lotus, say, or a flower would be opening simultaneously. So we can explore them like that, or we can explore them as a path, starting with faith and culminating in wisdom. So I've got a little very simple diagram that Vidyadhaka's going to turn over. So these are the two ways, very, very simple two ways of looking at it. But interestingly, they're quite different ways of looking at it, and I'm going to be talking about them in both ways. So in the first way, we've got them, I've drawn it a bit like a star, but if you can imagine it as something like a lotus opening, we often talk in Buddhism as a mandala. These qualities, they're all developing simultaneously. What we've got is we've got faith or shraddha at one point of the star and wisdom or pranya at the other point. They're opposite each other. And sometimes people talk about them balancing each other, but I don't really like the word balance because it sounds a bit... It can kind of feel a bit like you're going to the lowest common denominator. I like to think of them in creative tension with each other. They're qualities that are working off each other, faith and wisdom. Similarly, absorption and energy. So absorption, where you're going deeply into yourself, energy, where there's an outward movement. Faith and wisdom. It's all about imagination, you could say, and wisdom at least starts with reason. It goes beyond that. And then in the middle, you've got mindfulness, sort of holding all the creative tension. So that's one way you can look at them. Or you can look at them like a path or trajectory, starting with shraddha, culminating with pranya. So we're going to be exploring these five in both ways. Tonight, starting with faith, the Buddhist word is shraddha. So that's the starting point. Looked at it in terms of the path, that's the starting point. So a few things to say straight away is that in Buddhism, faith isn't the same as belief, and it's certainly not the same as blind belief. It's not really belief at all. It's not really faith in Buddhism isn't about being asked to sort of take on board a set of propositions. It's something different than that I'm going to unpack. And certainly not blind belief. There's no sort of place for that in Buddhism. In a certain way, what I'm going to explore as faith or shraddha this evening isn't religious at all. Talking about it in terms of Buddhism, well, in a sense, Buddhism itself isn't religious at all, you could say. It's not secular either, but it's not religious in the usual, the way we might think of religion. In terms of believing, the sort of blind belief notion. So faith or shraddha in Buddhism kind of isn't religious in the usual way. It's a human quality. It's a quality of being a human being. And I'm going to explore it under three aspects. And these three are, and as I say, I'm going to give us some information quite quickly so that there'll be a chance, hopefully, to ask some questions. So the first aspect of shraddha, or faith, is seeing things in a deeper way or with a deeper perspective. The second aspect is responsiveness to value. And the third aspect is confidence that growth, even Buddhahood itself, is possible for us, that it's not just something for other people, it's possible for us. So I'm going to go through each of these in turn. So first of all, seeing things in a deeper way. So this, it does involve the actual teachings of Buddhism. The actual doctrine, I guess, for want of a better word. So it does involve that, but it's not confined to that. It's certainly not confined to intellectual understanding, although it does include our intelligence. Yeah, it does include, there is a thinking aspect to it. It's quite important to say that we're not kind of leaving our intelligence at the door when we come into the Buddhist Centre. You'll be thankful to hear. It does involve our thinking faculty. We're not leaving that behind. What this aspect of Shraddha or faith is, maybe the best way to talk about it is to hopefully draw on something that if you've been coming to the Buddhist Centre for any length of time, you might have already encountered. See what you think about this. It's sort of that feeling, I know I had this when I first came along, that the things I was hearing at the Buddhist Centre, it was like they articulated what I kind of believed already, but I hadn't quite been able to put into words so far. So there was a sense of, oh yeah, that's what I think too. I didn't know how to say it. I didn't know how to articulate it. Maybe I didn't even really know that I thought it. But when I heard it, I thought there was a kind of, oh yes, that makes sense. Does that resonate with people to some extent? Yeah. I notice that one area I notice it in particular, in my work at the Buddhist Centre, at the Buddhist Centre, I'm what's known as the Mitra convener. A Mitra is someone who has decided to commit themselves to Buddhism to a certain extent. An order member, someone who has fully committed their life to the values of Buddhism. A Mitra is kind of a stage before that. Someone saying, "Oh yeah, this seems to make sense, and I want to explore it more deeply, and I'm going to commit myself thus far." So I'm very involved with people at that stage. And one of the things that we explore together is what's known as the precepts in Buddhism. Many of you all know about these precepts that Buddhists undertake to practice kindness, generosity, truthfulness, contentment, mindfulness. They're the principal precepts. And every time when I explore these with someone, again and again I hear people saying, what these precepts are articulating is how I've been trying to live my life, and this is making sense of it. So that seems to be what I hear again and again. So there you've got the precepts as a concrete example of the actual teacher and the actual doctrine, you could say, but then one's own experience resonating with that. So all the time when we're talking about faith in this way, of seeing things in a deeper way, it's like there's an interplay between the actual teachings and our own experience. And what I want to suggest, and you can see whether you agree with this or not, is that we need both these things, that one on its own is not enough. If we only had the teachings and we didn't relate that to our own experience, we'd fall into that area of blind belief, or else blind disbelief. We'd either just dismiss them, or else we'd take them on board unthinkingly. It's quite interesting, in the Buddhist canon, you've actually got that situation where one of the Buddha's disciples or one of the Buddha's devotees kind of comes along to the Buddha and said, I've learned all the teachings off by heart, aren't I good? And the Buddha admonishes him and says, no, you're not a good disciple for just learning the teachings off by heart. You actually need to think about them and test them in your own experience. Yes, yeah, so just the teachings on their own, it isn't enough. We've got to test them in our own experience. But at the same time, our own experience also isn't enough, because left to our own devices, well, this is what I've come to think, you can tell me whether you agree, is left to our own devices, we're very good at rationalising, you know, we're very good at thinking we're doing the right thing. But actually, we're just following the path of least resistance. we need something to check our experience against, yeah? So we look to the teachings and we check our experience against the teachings, but we look to our experience and we check the teachings against our experience. So these are in, they're in a constant sort of interplay, a constant sort of working off each other. So, and that's what intelligence really means, I think, is that we have to bring our intelligence to our Buddhist practice. We can't just take stuff on board. That wouldn't be right. But neither can we just follow our own track, unless we were a Buddha. The only person who could really follow their own track is a Buddha, because the Buddha, a Buddha, an enlightened being, is wise enough to be able to trust their own instincts. Unenlightened, we're not. Well, I'm certainly not wise enough to trust my own instincts. My own instincts, well, will tell me to do all sorts of things in my sort of weaker moments that actually aren't going to lead to my own growth and not even my own happiness. My own instincts that say, you know, I'm not going to say I'm sorry because I'm right, you know. Or my own instincts that say, oh, you know, just give yourself a day off. You know, you've worked hard enough at this meditation, Lark. You know, that's what I mean by going along the sort of path of least resistance. It's then that I need the teachings, which sometimes, you know, just come in the form of a good friend that reminds me, you know, you're better than that. You can do more than that. So this is the first aspect of faith. It's seeing things in a deeper way. It's when it's not just a sort of calm agreement with the teachings of the Dharma, the teachings of Buddhism. It's that kind of, yes, yes, I sort of knew I believed this. I knew this is what I thought about life, but this has articulated it. So it's a conviction, but it's a conviction rooted in the way things actually are. Because again, we can have all sorts of convictions about all sorts of things, but not always rooted in the way things are. So it's conviction tested by reason. It's conviction weighed against the actual teaching. So this aspect of faith is traditionally known as deep faith in realities. Yeah, so it's a deep faith, it's that deep yes, but it's in realities. It's not just a conviction in a fantasy. It's a conviction in the realities. Conviction in realities such as acting kindly will actually not only benefit other beings, but will actually benefit myself. Acting unkindly will be the opposite, for example. It's that sort of yes. When we come along to the Buddha Center and hear, you know, a teaching such as you know, if we place our faith on things that are actually impermanent, that are actually, if we're seduced by the sort of appearance of things, actually we'll never find happiness. There's always unsatisfactoriness in the things that are material and things that are just the sort of appearances of the world. We think, oh yes, like I knew that, didn't I? I knew that. So there's a resonance in our being with that. So that's the first aspect of Shraddha. The second one is this one, responsiveness to value. So when we're thinking about this quality, this is the quality. It's the quality that the human quality that perceives beauty, that perceives truth, that perceives goodness. It's that faculty in us that when we see someone being kind, it moves us. When we see someone do a brave thing, we're affected by it. Sometimes in spite of ourselves, isn't it? When we hear someone speaking the truth, we know that. It's an interesting faculty, that, isn't it? Because we can't measure it scientifically. We can't Well, we can't measure it scientifically, but we do. But I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about when I say that faculty in us that, I remember an article, it must have been at least a year ago now, just, well, there's many articles in the newspaper, just, a man on a Greek island, someone's coming over in a boat drowning. He just, without thinking, goes and, lifts the woman out, saves her, The humanness in him is responding to the humanness in her. He's not thinking, he's not thinking in terms of, who's an asylum seeker or refugee or whatever. He's just the humanness in him is responding to the humanness in her. Then, we read the story and, we're the faculty in us that has that capacity of being moved, responds to that. So that's I think it's I think to me it's what a human being is, is having possession of that faculty. It's very close to the sort of aesthetic responsiveness. It's very close to when we respond to beauty and art or nature, but it's very similar to that response to truth, that response to goodness. It's natural in us. Although it's natural, and it's part of being human, it can be cultivated. And if we're to sort of lead, I think, if we're to lead a more and more worthwhile life, it's something that we can actively cultivate, just as we can cultivate it in the aesthetic way. I've been interested myself in how much the aesthetic sensibility can be cultivated. A few years ago, I decided, just as a practice, that I would read some poetry every morning before meditation. And what I noticed is over time, over a couple of years, it's like my capacity for poetry has increased, whereas before I could just about manage a few short poems. And a few sort of easy ones, I dip into anthologies, where now, a whole new world of delights opened up, for me, where I can enjoy more and more difficult work. It doesn't feel difficult, though. It would have felt difficult to me a few years ago, but now I think, oh, great, it's very, very enjoyable. So that, although it's natural to us, it can be drawn out. It can be cultivated. And if what I'd like to suggest is if we're to lead a meaningful life, this is something we can cultivate more and more, our capacity to respond to, well, not just beauty in terms of aesthetic beauty, but beauty that's more sort of akin to goodness, beauty that's more akin to truth. We can cultivate that more and more. For Buddhists, of course, the greatest beauty is the beauty of the three jewels, the Buddha or the ideal of enlightenment, the Dharma, the truth itself, the teachings, and the Sangha, the spiritual community. And what we're trying to cultivate is a response of delight in these three jewels. And there's something important to say about this. Is that if we're going to do this, the starting point is ourselves and what we respond to. It's like, yes, we can cultivate this responsiveness. At the same time, nobody can sort of tell another person what is beautiful or not. Do I mean that? We can learn from each other. I know I very much learned from a friend who's very into visual art. I've learned to look at paintings in a new way through his, well, education, really. So we can learn from each other, but we can't impose what we think is beautiful on ourselves from outside. We've got to start from where we are. I was thinking of this, I was talking to another friend recently, and she'd been on holiday, I can't remember where it was, I think it was Florence or Madrid or somewhere where there's art galleries full of kind of wonderful work. She was there with her boyfriend and he was really enjoying the looking at the art, at the angels and so on. And she you know, she said she had to admit actually it was leaving her a bit cold. And she said, actually, and I think she was rather bemused by this, she said that what had actually moved her the most was seeing a small, peaceful demonstration of a group of people. She didn't even know what they were demonstrating. I think they were outside a bank demonstration. She said, strangely enough, that moved her the most. But actually, I was really encouraging her to look more deeply at what I asked her, well, what moved you about that? And she said, well, the solidarity between the people. And she said the fact, in a way, they were fighting against the odds. You know, they were such a small group. They probably weren't going to be make much change, but yet they were still willing to do that. So her responsiveness was responding to that. Maybe, you know, do you see what I mean? She thought she should be responding to the paintings, but in actual fact, what she was responding to was equally valuable for her. And not only that, it was important that she takes that seriously. If she kind of tries to make herself respond to something, she tries to import her responsiveness, it's never going to work. It's like trying to build something on no foundations. You've got to, if you're going to work in this way, you've got to see what you yourself respond to. Look for the value in that, and there was value in that, and then build from there. So, yeah, so this responsiveness to value, it's very kind of, it's like kind of, again, I want to say starting point, but it's not something you leave behind. You start with it, but you don't leave it behind. But we wanna encourage this faculty in ourselves, educate it, draw it out, and that means starting from where we are. Where do we see beauty? One of the things I was talking about this today in the little video that we sent out. One of the key ways to work like this is this practice or non-practice of doing nothing. This is if we're going to work with our imagination, which is what this aspect's really about. We need to make space for that. Very, very hard in this day and age. I think it's hard for two reasons, really. One, because as many of us have been talking about already on the urban retreat, we're just maybe even more in this day and age, but I'm not sure, actually. I'm sure it was true in the Buddha's time, but just in different ways. We're just so sort of addicted to the surface of our minds. We so want that kind of instant, it's not even really gratification, instant distraction provided by, well, everything from our phones to whatever we turn to when we've got a moment's gap in our lives. We quickly want to fill it. It can feel almost hard to bear sometimes, that little or large gap. So I think this a practice of doing nothing can start just as simply as just noticing the gaps, even the gap in a conversation between two people, even the gap, or the kind of gap when you're sitting in a cafe with something and they nip off to the toilet. What do we do in that moment? Like most of us, well, if you're like me, you pick up our phone, if you haven't, you know, or read the menu, or, you know, what would it be like just to experience that gap? Can be quite disconcerting to allow ourselves to experience that. But if we don't allow ourselves some pauses, we'll kill our imagination, actually. Our imagination won't really have a look in. So I think the practice, it's hard, I don't even want to call it a practice. You call it a practice, sounds like it's something to do, where it's more like we're trying not to do something. We're trying for just a moment or two or longer in a day to do nothing. So it can be difficult because we get bored or a bit disconcerted. It can also be difficult because it feels like we're wasting time, and that's not a valid option. I know from myself, I've just done quite a long retreat. I've just spent 5 months on retreat, actually, 2 months of which I was completely on my own. And even on my own, it was quite hard to do nothing. Even I noticed, even when I was on my own, even meditation could become a thing to do. And what I noticed in my mind was, I wanted to go back and have something to show for it. I wanted to go back and say, well, I had this 2 months on retreat, but I had all these great insights and I did all this great meditation. So even there I am, I'm on a Spanish mountain on my own. I know I'm wanting to prove something. I'm wanting to, I want to have something to write home about. I want to have something to show for it. So even to, you know, just spend even, you know, 10 minutes, half an hour, literally doing nothing was difficult. Very strange, isn't it? Because no one's ever going to know what I did or didn't do. But there I was, sort of censoring my own behaviour, judging my own behaviour. So I'm still working on it, this practice of doing nothing. And I would very much encourage it. When I have managed to do it, I've noticed that just spend 5 or 10 or 15 minutes literally doing nothing, just sitting in a chair, just trying to be aware, I've noticed that my sort of subsequent actions, hard to say this without sounding a bit jargony, I was going to say, it's like they come from somewhere different. They might even be the same. I might, you know, it's not that I'm doing anything grand after that. I might just be going having a cup of tea, going to the shops, I don't know, doing the hoovering or something, but it sort of comes from a different, perhaps more spontaneous place, rather than a frenetic, I've got to fill this gap, I've got to prove myself, I've got to, you know, I've got to have something to show for my day, my life, it's more like a sort of, things come from a more, perhaps even more joyful place. Maybe I don't even mean joyful in that I'm going around with a big grin on my face, but just kind of happier, more contented place. So that's a practice of doing nothing, and that's we do that in order to free our imagination, and we do that so that we can live more from this second aspect of Shraddha, which is responsiveness to value. This aspect of faith is faith in values, faith in qualities, and it's traditionally known as lucid faith, because it comes from a sort of growing sense of clarity of what's really worthwhile in life. Yeah, what's really worthwhile in life is value, rather than the things that that I often spend my time doing. Actually, it's from a growing confidence that values such as truth and beauty and, dare I say, goodness are the most important things. So there becomes more and more of a lucidity about that. So that's the second aspect of faith. And then the third one, the third aspect of faith is called, it's the aspect of confidence. So it's confidence that growth is possible for us, that it's not just something for other people. It's a desire to realise our potential, even a longing to realise our potential, but a confidence that that is possible.
If you remember back to the line we said when we did the ritual earlier on, the little threefold ritual,
it's sort of epitomised in that line. We say, the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. So in Buddhism, it's absolutely primary that the Buddha was born as a human being.
And the whole big implication for us is that if the Buddha, born a human being, could realize this state that we call enlightenment, then that means it must be possible for every human being, and that means us too. But that can be difficult. We can sort of problematize that quite easily. Something that that helps me when I'm sort of problematizing that, thinking it doesn't really mean me, is something that my own teacher, Sangharakshita, once said to someone who went along with this very issue. So the sort of little story was that someone went along to Sangharakshita saying, you know, this growth, this enlightenment, I'm sure it's fine for everyone else, but like I just can't make it. I can't do it. And Sangharakshita apparently said, "Oh, what makes you so special?" which is kind of funny, isn't it? But also, it's got quite a deep meaning, that, because it's a sort of inverted pride when we think I'm so special. It's making everything a bit personal. It's kind of, if we sort of think, oh, I'm the only one and I'm the only one that can't do this, we're kind of missing the point. And the point is just trust the practices, you know, just trust that if we do meditate, we become a bit more mindful, we become a bit more metaphor. Don't over-personalise it. So that is the three aspects of faith, and I've written them on the next page. So we've got deep faith in realities, we've got lucid faith in qualities, and we've got longing faith in capacities. And then I've drawn these little pictures. Well, actually, Sangharakshita kindly drew these for me. So head, heart, and legs. So that's quite a good way to remember them. So there's the deep faith in realities, that's the understanding the teachings and resonating with that. There's the lucid faith in realities, that's the sort of emotional aspect of faith. And then there's the longing faith in capacities, that's the legs, you know. That's the action, that's how we actually act, and that's the belief that growth is possible for every human being, including ourselves. So I'm going to stop talking here because I want to leave a bit of time for any questions or comments. I've given quite a lot of information in this first talk, but I do ask for any questions or clarification. Yes.
Would you say that mindfulness is the same as enlightenment, or that enlightenment is more of a universal kind of thing? I don't know if that makes sense. But because you were saying to attain, enlightenment a kind of subjective thing in terms of everyone can. I'm sort of struggling to kind of distinguish between mindfulness and enlightenment.
Okay.
Whether mindfulness is kind of the route to enlightenment, or whether it is a form of enlightenment.
So I think I understand your question. So mindfulness is an aspect of enlightenment. So an enlightened being would be, like, certainly mindful, not just in the sense of, not just mindful in the way we often talk about mindfulness is things like being present to one's experience and so on, but would be mindful of like all aspects of, you know, if you were enlightened, you'd be mindful of yourself, you'd be mindful of other people, so you'd have complete awareness of other people and your own actions in regard to other people. You'd be completely mindful of your effect on the world, and you'd be mindful of reality itself, so you'd be mindful of like dharmic truths, like all things are impermanent, that happiness is never to be realized in this mundane world. So you'd be, that would be mindfulness in its fullness. So it wouldn't just be it would include, but it wouldn't just be, say, being mindful of one's own actions, yeah, and one's own self, yeah. So it would be a sort of panoramic awareness, would be both a means to what we call enlightenment and an aspect of it. So enlightenment would include this panoramic awareness. It would also include infinite compassion. It would also include like boundless energy, continual creativity. So it's like enlightenment's got many facets. Mindfulness would be one of them. But also the practice of mindfulness itself, sort of imbued with, it would have to start being imbued with wisdom, which we're going to come on to, and then it can be a route to enlightenment. Yeah, does that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah?
Yeah, some kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think, yeah. Yes.
Does deep faith in realities, would that include things like rebirth or karma, things that are less obvious or
yeah. Yeah. So, well, certainly the law of karma, which is a big subject in itself, but the law of karma is sort of put simply states that all intentional actions have consequences on oneself. Yeah. So it certainly would include, it would include really understanding that teaching more and more deeply, testing it in one's experience, and continually sort of honing one's understanding of it. Yeah. So all the teachings of Buddhism, yeah.
And those ones that are perhaps more related to your experience or more not faith-based, but say rebirth.
Right, so that's interesting, isn't it?
Okay.
So that's a good question because rebirth, so Buddhism traditionally does talk in terms of rebirth, but that is something that, well, no one knows, you know, no one knows. So actually, so that's where it gets interesting, because just to believe in it because the Buddha talked about it, you'd be in danger of falling into blind faith, yeah? But to dismiss it out of hand, you'd be in danger of just thinking, oh, well, I'm only going to go by my own experience. So that's where you're at, something more is asked of you. So something that's neither just taking it on board, but neither dismissing it out of hand, is to think, well, what does that mean? And why would the Buddha have talked in those terms? What do Buddhists actually mean when they talk about rebirth? Which I won't totally go into it just now because it's the whole subject of a talk, but, you know, it's not reincarnation, for example. It's something more subtle. It's asking of you to discover what is really meant by rebirth, and that would mean some exploration. So, yeah. So I think that's a very good one to sort of bring up. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I'm stuck on the doing nothing.
Ah, okay, yeah, good, yeah.
So I understand that you can physically do nothing.
Okay.
So you can, like, go sit on a bench and yeah. So then are you meant to just not even, like, think about anything? You're just looking at what's happening in front of you?
Okay.
So what, I did something meant to, like, do nothing.
Okay, so that's good, yeah. Yes, because actually, I mean, in a strict sense, this side of enlightenment, we're always doing something, yeah? But what it means is, what I'm doing when I'm doing nothing is I'm trying to, like, consciously resist things like planning, well, consciously trying to resist the external things first, like phone or making lists or something. Then in my mind, I'm consciously trying to resist planning, fantasizing and so on, but my mind will always tend to do that. So every time I notice that, I'm trying to just become aware. Just like a very simple way to do this is just come back to one's physical experience. Okay, here I am sitting on this bench. Come back to that. I can hear birds, I can hear traffic. just come back to the sort of here and now, then, you know, one's mind will spin off, but just continually come back. Yeah? So, I mean, we're kind of doing that when we're meditating as well, but the trouble is even meditating can become a, we can fall into that, becomes another thing to do. So we can the doing nothing can be best just like literally, yeah, sitting on a bench or sitting in an armchair. We're less likely then to think, oh, I'm doing something. Yeah, but yeah, you're quite right. Well, our mind will always be tending to go either to spin off or to get really sleepy. So the art is to try and be aware and alert and at the same time just at ease and relaxed. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give it a go.
What's that?
I'll give it a go.
Give it a go, yeah. It's really, yeah. Yeah. Yes.
One quite interesting idea of the stillness. A guy that did the talk, one of the talks, the sort of Dharma talk, and he discussed the idea of a glass of water and some sand.
Yeah.
In the water.
Yeah.
It's heavier than
yeah.
the water, but if the glass is moving,
yeah.
the sand moves around.
Yes. Yeah. It's
still.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lovely image, isn't it? That the mind will tend to settle, yeah. Yeah, and become clear. So it's a good image because there's sort of settledness, but also there's the clarity of the water, yeah. 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 Or, and, you know, it's interesting just to notice what the mind does do, you know, because, you know, ideally it will do that, but maybe we get bored or agitated or something. So then we just can notice that, yeah. Yeah, so the mind will naturally settle, but we can't make it settle. So again, we've got to watch for trying to think, like Thomas trying to, like, you know, press the sand of the mind down. Yeah, it's got to be natural. Yeah. Yes.
Can I take you back to the last question?
Yes.
The idea of being completely mindful, it sounds like, well, it sounds to me like omniscience, but it's not, I know that it's not that, so I wondered if you could kind of talk about the difference between, I guess, knowledge and awareness.
Ah, okay, yeah, yeah.
It feels like to be completely aware of something,
yeah.
to know it. So to be completely aware of everything, you need to know everything. But then it feels like there's a jump in logic that I've done somewhere there.
Okay.
I don't know where I've gone.
Okay, yeah, and I think I understand your question. And I think it might kind of tie in with the second aspect of faith and value. So a Buddha, an enlightened being, would... The awareness would be the awareness of what's important, yeah? So, for example, a traditional example, well, it can't be that traditional because it's a bit modern day, for example, is like, say, a car, say something like a car. Now, a Buddha wouldn't necessarily know how the car was made or even how to drive it or how to, the components. So it's not omniscience in that sense. But what a Buddha would know is that is an object, so it's subject to impermanence. It can't in itself deliver happiness, and so on. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we know that intellectually, but a Buddha would know that deeply. Yeah. So would see the it has come into being in dependence on conditions. It will pass away, and it can't deliver happiness. Yeah, so that so it's like, and we can cultivate that more deep knowing. Yeah, I mean, we kind of know our car can't give us happiness, but do we really know that? You know, our car substitute anything, whatever one's craving. And so it's that kind of knowing. Yeah. Yeah, does that, I want to check that that's addressed. So even a Buddha wouldn't know, well, all sorts of things, you know, all sorts of things about the world, but would know what's, that's why I thought it tied in with that level of faith that's to do with value. Would know things to do with value. Yeah.
I guess so far I've been thinking about mindfulness as being more mindful of what's in front of you.
Yeah.
Which, like, it almost feels like being more mindful is almost like getting a sort of psychic quality, you know, like knowing more than I could know before because I'm being more mindful of what's in front of me. That's a kind of far more kind of superpower-esque way of describing it than I think I
know. Yeah, it is more vast than just knowing what's in front of you, but. And maybe thinking of it as a superpower is useful, but it's not like, it's natural. It's not like sort of magic. It's like it's like knowing, for example, actions of consequence. It's having more imagination, more empathy, you could say. So being mindful of how our actions are affecting other people, that will, as we practice more meditation, that will grow in us. But it will be natural. So that by the time we're enlightened, like, we couldn't hurt another being because that would be so acute in us. We'll be mindful of that to such an acute degree. You know, but, you know, if you've been practicing meditation, you already may feel that to some extent, that some things are just more difficult to do. So that's, it's an aspect of, you could say, of mindfulness. It's also an aspect of faith because it's like our value, our sense of value has become more, our sensibility to that's greater. Yeah? Yes.
Was there like a turning point in your life that kind of drew you deeper into the faith, or was it something, like you said, that you kind of always had a belief in but just kind of developed with time?
Ah, well, sort of both, actually. I certainly remember my very first encounter with the Buddhist Centre. I think there was that first aspect of faith, a kind of, oh, like, these people are speaking what I've somehow always thought, but I never knew how to put into words. So there's that sort of, yeah, it was, this makes sense, but not as something imposed on me, something like that resonated with me. So I think the very first encounter was a turning point. I thought, this is definitely something I'm not going to turn back on. I knew that straight away. But then it's been more gradual and still continues. Yeah, this especially I think that second aspect, the responsiveness to value, I can see that it's something that's, well, never ending. And I find that very exciting. That, I mean, earlier on I said that wisdom's a culmination, but even that isn't an end point. Even like a Buddha isn't a kind of arrival, as I know, oh, that's me done it now.
Yeah.
Even for an enlightened being, that responsiveness, our creativity continues. I find that very inspiring and exciting. Yeah. How are we doing? Oh, I think we've actually gone over time. So I think we have to end there. So thank you for joining us this evening in this very kind of whistle-stop tour of the first of these five vital qualities of the mind, faith. Tomorrow evening, we're going to explore the second, which is energy. We're going to be doing that with Vidyadhaka. The third evening, we're going to be exploring mindfulness. I mentioned that particularly because quite a few of the questions have been on mindfulness, and that's going to be with Shraddha Siddhi. And then we'll go on to the last two on Thursday and Friday. Very much I hope to see you. The other evenings. I very much hope to see you tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. We'll be there for those of you who can make it. And thanks for joining us this evening.